It seems investigating murders in South Carolina's Lowcountry is really turning into a thing. That's why we've created another podcast focusing specifically on the murder of Stephen Smith. We, of course, have continuing coverage for you on the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. But if you want a channel exclusively dedicated to the coverage of the investigation and finding justice for Stephen Smith, be sure to search and press subscribe to The Murder of Stephen Smith. Search that wherever you download podcasts and press subscribe as we bring you daily coverage of the investigation into the murder of Stephen Smith and the quest for justice. Search The Murder of Stephen Smith wherever you get podcasts. Hope you're having a great weekend. This is our week in review, a look back at some of the most compelling stories we've covered for you in the last 7 days. Brand new episodes back Monday, right here.
You're listening to the Hidden Killers podcast.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Laura Uretzian still with us. We're going to be talking about the Daybells. Laura, one of the nation's premier defense attorneys. So, that being said, you know your stuff. I'm just going to throw it at you. How on earth does one defend Lori Daybell as she prepares to go to trial here in the coming weeks?
Not an easy one, especially the way she behaved when her children were missing.
Yes.
And my guess is that the way you would defend her is by pointing the finger at others, including her brother, who's now deceased. Uh-huh. That's probably the best way to defend her and basically say, I don't know what the position is going to be, but basically say that she either didn't know about it or she found out after the fact that her brother may have done it. Just point the finger at someone else is the best way to get out of it. And an easy target would be the deceased brother, who seems to have been very close to her and involved and may have committed other crimes as well.
It does seem like an easy attempt. The timeline is pretty tight there as well, though, of was he alive when the children were killed or went missing? Because we don't really have the exact dates on either of those.
Exactly. And I'm sure the defense has more information than we do.
Sure.
So that's something that may come up during the trial. I don't know if she going to point the finger at her husband. That's also a possibility. We don't know. We know that the best thing that could have happened to them is the fact that they've got separate trials, especially for Chad, because, mm-hmm. you know, just being connected to Lori is not the best thing right now. Mm-hmm. She also has sounds like she's got some mental health issues. Maybe that's the way they're going to go.
Well,
that's also a possibility.
And that's what's been said recently, is that they don't want to go down the mental health road with this in trial, which I'm kind of surprised by. Before we talk about that, tell me, why is this a better thing for the both of them to have this separated, in your opinion?
When they're together, especially for Chad, I mean, if he's with her, the case is going to be presented to the jury. She's not the most, neither one is the most sympathetic, and it's easier to point the finger at the other when the other is not there. Mm-hmm. Overall, I think it's just much, much better when each is facing a jury on their own and can present their defense and they've got that freedom versus both in the courtroom. It's just a lot heavier when both defendants are together. The jury might look at one as the one who played a more minor role, but if you're sitting next to the person that they believe played a major role in the killings, then automatically there's this transference, right, of guilt. Mm-hmm. So it's always better for them to be separate so the lawyers can point fingers at whoever they want to point the finger at. And if one is, if the prosecution is going to present one as the one who was an accessory after the fact or played a minor role, at least there's not that transference of guilt or the heaviness of the other individual being in the courtroom in the same room during the trial. To me, it's a better thing. It's the best thing that could have happened to them.
Do you think we're going to see two very different trials between Lori and Chad, or is the Lori trial going to be kind of like the warm-up round and then they get it all down of what's working and what's not working, and then basically press repeat when they go into trial with Chad.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's a repeat, but there's got to be some evidence that may be different for Chad's case. Again, I can't tell you for sure, but the prosecution, and I've seen it in other cases, where there's two individuals, all right, and there's, let's say, one murder, and they can't tell really who did it. And I've seen them start with the first trial and argue, for example, in this case, Lori did it, and have the jury convict based on that argument, and then have Chad go to trial and then argue that Chad did it. He pulled the trigger or whatever it may be, right? Whatever the means was. And get a conviction that way. I've seen that before and it's possible. So I don't know what this prosecution is going to do. It all depends on what happens in the first case. I'm not sure exactly what their theory is going to be as far as who they think did this, how they think did it, when it happened. What's the forensic evidence connecting the mom or Lori to the crimes? Can they place her at the scene of the crime? There's a lot of ifs here and gaps that I'm not really sure what the answers are to. And we're going to find out during the trial. We'll have to see. It's going to be an interesting one.
Throughout the buildup to this and the investigation of all this, even up until the point when they were arrested, one of their big things was believing that people had turned into what they called zombies. Basically, people that were no longer people. They had different identities and they were evil and they were possessed and they had to die in order to, I guess, be cleansed or come back as something else. And this is their philosophy. This is their religion in the terms of how they believe. Obviously, you can't square murder into any sort of religion and say that that is your defense. But how much can they rely or push their belief system, no matter how crazy it may be? Because if you look at every religion, anyone could argue that their other one is crazy if it's not what one believes. Because there's a lot of magical thinking that goes on in almost any religion. This one, a little bit more magical than others. Can that be used as a defense of, look, these people truly thought and believe that they were doing the right thing? Yes, it ended up in the death of children, but is that something that can be brought up in terms of defense for when it comes to sentencing or anything of that nature? Does it weigh on the trial? Does it weigh on how a jury would view them?
I don't think it's going to be a defense, I can tell you that. No jury with a straight face is going to say, yeah, sure, your religion says you've got to kill all these people who you think are possessed and they're zombies. Sure.
Seems no legit. Jury's
going to put up with it. There's not, yeah. And that's not a defense. You know, that's not a legal defense. It's not, maybe in mitigation for sentencing. Maybe for sentencing, it can come in, not necessarily because it's just a belief, but because there's some serious mental health issues here. I mean, the idea that anyone would believe that, you know, people are possessed and they're zombies and would kill them for that reason is an indication that there is something neurologically, psychologically, or psychiatrically, emotionally wrong with that individual.
And if she's still believing,
that's obvious.
If she's still believing this doctrine, I'll call it, from Chad,
right,
who came up with all these ideas. Do you believe personally that she's fit to stand trial if she still believes that what they did was right?
Well, her fitness to stand trial doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with her belief system and what's reasonable.
Okay.
The way they decide whether somebody's fit to stand trial is, technically, the client has to be able to help herself and help her attorneys and work with her attorneys, right, to defend her. As long as she can communicate with her attorneys and is able to work with them, help them, give them the information that they need, you know, be interviewed by them, go through the evidence with them, be an integral part of the defense, and also understand the proceedings that she's going through. Understand that this is a trial. Understand that the rights she has. know what day it is, the date, time. Mm-hmm. As long as she's got all of that, just because she's got the strange set of beliefs or religious beliefs doesn't mean she's not fit to stand trial.
So if she's there with her defense, and yes, she can tell you what day it is, what time it is, what she had for lunch. She can talk about some of the things she saw on TV, on some show that she was watching, and really all fit there until it comes to talking about the kids with the attorneys. And like, oh yeah, they had to go. They were zombies, and it just is.
But
right.
That's a mental health issue. That yeah. doesn't necessarily mean she's not fit to stand okay. trial. As long as she understands the proceedings she's in. For example, mm-hmm. she knows she's being tried yep. for the murder of her children. She understands what she's going through, the proceedings, sure. the trial, her right to present evidence, the right to confront witnesses. Yep. She's involved in her defense, whether it's a strange defense or not, it's mm-hmm. a different story. But she, I mean, if that's what her belief system was, and that's why she did it, and if she's telling her lawyers that, then it is what it is. But that doesn't mean, but if she says, I don't know what this is, what do you mean trial? Oh, I'm going to okay. go to jail? No way. None of that is, that's not real. That's magical. She starts saying stuff like that.
That's
then yes, she's not okay. fit to stand trial. But if she understands the proceedings,
yeah. right,
she knows what she's going through and is able to work with her lawyers.
Yeah.
Answer their questions, whether we like the answers or not is a secondary issue, but she's working with them, explains what's going on, helps them with the defense. You know what? Were you here on such and such day? No, I wasn't there. This is where I was. And here's the picture that can help you go try and get it through the evidence on this from my phone. Like she's able to communicate and explain and help herself.
Okay.
As long as she's doing all of that, she's fit to stand trial, even if she's got some mental health issues. Now they can maybe raise those mental health issues during the trial as part of the defense or later as mitigation for sentencing. That's a different story. But again, fitness, people sometimes confuse fitness with mental health,
sure.
fitness to stand trial, and it's not the same thing. It's two different things.
So as long as she can understand that she's on trial and that the outside world views what she did as wrong, even though she disagrees with it, she's fit to stand trial because she just disagrees with what the rules are of society, and she views that what she did was right, but she knows she's on trial for it. That means she's fit.
The key is this. If she understands the nature of the proceedings she's going through, mm-hmm. she knows, for example, some of the questions that they ask them when they're evaluating a defendant on fitness to stand trial are, you know, what day is it today? What year is it? Where are you? What are you going through? Trial, what stage of the trial? Do you understand what that means?
Uh-huh.
Do you understand what the consequences of it can be? Yes, yes. And they can explain, you know, they can articulate things. Some of those are part of the interview that they go through with a psychiatric or psychological evaluators, a forensic psychologist, right?
Yeah.
And if she gives those right answers, her defense is not something that they discuss.
They're planning
out the defense or the nature of her defense. They're understanding the proceedings.
Sure. And they're expecting this trial to last possibly up to 10 weeks. Has it ever happened? Does this happen where maybe midway through her defense says, we don't think she's fit anymore. We think something triggered her. Something happened.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Absolutely. That could happen. I've had a case where at the beginning of trial it happened. And I've declared doubt mid. It could happen at any point. It could be at the beginning of the trial, months before the trial, mid-trial, towards the end of trial. At any time the lawyer notices that this person is incompetent to stand trial, it is unable to help her lawyers in defending her, no longer understands the nature of the proceedings, is lost, you know, just lost, then that's something that the lawyers would have to bring to the court's attention and declare a doubt about her competency to stand trial.
And then it would be up to the court to decide whether to proceed or to pause and mistrial. Like what are the options at that point?
The court would hold a hearing and make a decision on, after hearing some testimony, and make a decision on whether this individual, the defendant, is competent to stand or fit to stand trial. And if the person's not, I'm assuming at that point there's going to be a motion for a mistrial. And it would be, we would have a mistrial. And then once she's competent again, they'll start again.
Back to square one, basically.
back to square one.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast.
The Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Brewski.
Laurie Ratzian, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insight with us. We always appreciate it. If you want to weigh in on any of the things that we've been talking about, we got a phone number for that. It's 888-5-KILLER, 888-554-5537. Weigh in with your thoughts 24/7. We may even use them on a future episode of the program. My name's Tony Brewski. You can follow me on Tony B Pod on Twitter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.